Hello and welcome to this episode of The Broadcast. And this week we're going to be taking a look at all things trustee secretarial. And I'm joined by Chris McCarthy and Catherine Fenton, who are both senior consultants here at Broadstone and both well-experienced secretaries. And they sit on our secretarial working group. They sit around every month talking about all things that trustees need to know regards to what they need to do with their governance. And so we're just going to talk through some of the big issues on their agenda right now. So before I bring them in, I'm going to ask a question of Chris. So Chris, we're going to first look at the general code. I think it'd be almost impossible to do a session like this without noting the general code's existence. It's been a year since it's been laid and almost a year since it came into force. So I'm just interested in getting your thoughts and then hopefully Catherine's thoughts on what sort of common approaches and how your trustee boards have been working their way through the weighty tome that is the code.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, I think my experience is that initially it was a bit of a slow start, particularly before the code was laid. Since it's been laid, we've gathered a bit of pace, and probably 50 to 60% of trustee boards are starting to engage properly. If you're looking only at lay trustees, then it's probably slightly less, but the professional trustees obviously are engaging a lot more. But the common trends seem to be, and I think it's sort of broadly across the industry as much as across Broadstone, is that schemes are going for a gap analysis first to determine where they stand against the requirements of the code. And there's a couple of different ways that they're doing it. We've been sort of, a lot of schemes, we've been looking at a gap analysis light, so just a light touch, what policies do you have and what do you need? Other schemes have gone down a sort of more full-on line-by-line gap analysis, looking at every single policy. But I think, Catherine, I think that the experience will be the same, that most schemes have gone down the lighter touch approach. And then one or two schemes, probably about one in 10, have gone down the ignore everything we've done before and full suite of documents approach, which is not necessarily my personal preference, because I think doing the gap analysis shows that clients have had some governance in place that they're reasonably comfortable with in the first place.
Yeah, I think my experience is similar. Most trustees now have got to the point where they've done their gap analysis. They're quite comfortable with now with what they're expected to be doing by the regulator. And they're now at the point of targeting some of those higher priority items that have come out of that gap analysis process. So putting in place some of those policies that perhaps they were lacking before, or things that are new from the regulator that weren't there before. So that's the sort of stage that most of mine are in now, and they've got more comfortable now. I think initially was a bit scared that it was going to be tear up everything you've got, we need everything new, but obviously that's not the case, and it's more about tweaking what you've already got to make it comply with what the regulator expects. So I think a lot of the trustees now are much more comfortable with it. They're working through it, they're recording their decisions as they go in their minutes, and keeping an actions log is quite a good thing that some of them have been doing. So they're ticking off those sort of red key priority items, and then they're working their way through those amber and green ones as we go.
I think, yeah, the gap analysis is giving comfort, actually, as a first piece of work. It's giving a lot of trustees comfort in that, oh my God, we don't have a decision policy, or we don't have a policy on investment decisions. But actually, you look at your SIP, and there's your policy on investment decisions. They might have just forgotten it was in there. So there are a lot of things like that that actually exist and that don't need any more work. So, and the gap analysis is bringing those out. And I think, Catherine, you're right in that the main gaps that we're seeing are the new requirements, which is a good sign, really, I think, for a lot of schemes. But I think one thing that is coming out of it is trustee training, or rather documented trustee training. Probably a lot of my post-gap analysis work is looking at bringing training up to date, or at least bringing training logs up to date. And that seems to be the main sort of non-new requirement gap.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, one of the things that I've experienced is cybersecurity. That has been the one topic out of all of them that my trustees are really keen to get on board with, because they realise it's a real live risk. Pension schemes have got a lot of data that actually could be quite an attractive target. So I think they're all really willing to get on top of that, put in place a policy, and they really want to understand it. But we're having problems that it's such a specialised topic. There's an awful lot of jargon talked about. I don't think most of us fully understand how a cyber attack works. And obviously it can work in lots of different ways. So I think my trustees are struggling to find, in particular, appropriate training to get them up to speed with all of this. And some of them have been lucky enough that they've been able to draw from their sponsoring employer. So they might have an in-house cyber expert that they've been able to get some training from, or they've been able to at least review their policy and give them a bit of get some tips and advice on that. But others are not so lucky, so they've struggled a little bit with the training side of cybersecurity. And the other issue with it I found is that they're recommended by the regulator to go out to their third-party providers and advisors, ask what controls they've got in place for cybersecurity. But actually, it's quite difficult for them to assess what they get back, because without that expertise, how do they really know if that's appropriate, and if it's enough, and if it's good enough? So I think they're having to trust their providers quite heavily. And I think having those accreditations like Cyber Essentials or the ISO 27001, I think that's what we're having to rely on. If your provider can show that they've got those, at least that gives trustees some comfort level that those sort of nationally recognised standards are being met. But still, I think that it would be helpful to get a bit more training on cybersecurity, but it's difficult to find the right source, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
I've been using sort of the National Cybercrime Agency, which has some resources on there, which are aimed at corporates and company boards, but does have some sort of feed through into trustees. But it is notable that the regulator hasn't really stepped in much. We've got lots of resources on their website for sort of case studies around the Capita incident from a few years ago. And I know, you know, a few of our clients have had incidents at the sponsor where it brings it into sort of sharp focus. I suppose, I don't know if Chris, you were going to come in a second ago and I sort of talked over you, but it's like the incident plan is actually, even if, you know, as you're hinting at, Catherine, some of the controls aren't always clear, it's actually what is helpful to have something in place. It should the worst happen, what are you going to do and how are you going to cope should something happen? It's probably some ways more important because you can actually control and be involved with that process rather than the controls that you were saying are a bit more harder to pin down.
Yeah, I agree. And I was going to come in on a general training point, but the point there about the incident response plan or breach response plan, and it sounds easy. Okay, what we're going to put in our policy is to how we're going to respond to a breach. But actually, trustees need training on that specific bit as well, because they don't know what to do a lot. You know, and that's not being disrespectful. A lot of the time, they've never come across this situation. They wouldn't necessarily know what to do. So we can put the name of a chair, we can put a name of another trustee in the policy, but actually when they get the phone call to say, oh, we've had a cyber breach, how do they assess how bad that is and what needs to be done now? So specific training in that aspect needs to be done. And so we've gone through various different clients. I've had lawyers coming in to the training. And what one is lucky enough, one of our clients is a big accountancy firm. They've got in-house so the your usual compliance training that they've been able to roll out to the trustees as well, which has been really helpful. But not everyone has that option. It is about finding someone to do that. And yes, we could do it, but actually that's still us telling trustees, look how good we are, which isn't really the point.
Maybe not. But to be fair, some of us have got some experience of real life situations, and so that can be helpful. And we have our own cyber training. You know, we all do the cybersecurity training that we're meant to do, that compliance tell us we have to do every year. You know, so there is a certain amount of knowledge, and sometimes it's just bringing those trustees who maybe been out of the workforce for a while, so more mature trustees, may I say, in a polite way, you know, help them along. But it does bring into focus some of the other challenges that trustees face with the growth of technology, the growth of using online resources to do their job. You know, we try to sort of softly push them into, as we have done over since COVID really as well, that made a big change, was, you know, less paper packs, more online, more technology. And then how those things work actually becomes a big part of your cyber policy, because you've got a trustee sat at home rather than having loads of papers sitting around, which is worrying enough. Now they've got a laptop or a device somewhere with potentially lots of scheme information on, and how secure is that laptop, PC, iPad? And that brings into sharp focus as well around how the trustee board needs to work together and how the scheme can support trustees in dealing with the technology side of things.
Well, and advisors, because Catherine, you've probably been in the same position. You sit in a meeting, you say, right, let's use, you know, use Broadsun Engage, use your online portal because it's great. It's a great way to deal with some of the aspects of the code. And in your next breath, you're saying, cybersecurity, plan for when it happens because it's a when rather than an if. And suddenly you're telling trustees to use online and then scaring them completely away from online. So, yeah, a lot of those skills won't be familiar to them. And it's about managing their knowledge and helping with them with that.
I was just going to pull us a little bit back towards the general code again. We took a bit of a side turn into cyber, which is great, and I enjoyed it, and that was fantastic. But I did want to just cover off one other last little bit on the general code, because we've kind of talked very briefly about, you know, getting the ESOG in place and all those policies, the new policies, and in particular the cyber one, obviously, that we talked about. But the other thing, big thing, that the general code brings in is the own risk assessment, or the AURA. And I think a lot of trustees still probably have this in their too difficult pile just now. We're not quite ready for it yet. But Catherine, I don't know if you want to just give us your early thoughts on how that process might look for a board looking to begin that one.
Yeah, so I'm sure we're going to get comfortable with an own risk assessment in the same way that we've got through the general codes and now we're comfortable with it. It's just the starting point's quite difficult sometimes, isn't it? But this is the last piece of the puzzle, really, if you like, for the general code work, is this AURA own risk assessment. So for schemes with more than 100 members, they're going to have to work through this process of looking at how effective their governance is and how well they manage their risks. So I think the regulator's point is, that's great, you've got all these policies and governance in place, but actually, is it being followed? Is it working well for you? Can it be further improved, possibly? So that is the intention of this process. The first AURA you'll need to do will need to be within 2 full scheme years after the general code came to force in March last year. So, for example, if your year end is the 1st of April, you'll need to be completing your first AURA by the 1st of April 2026. So I think most schemes are going to be finding later on this year, they're going to start working on this, thinking about how they're going to take this process forward. And then once it's done for the first time, you'll need to repeat it at least every 3 years as well. Unfortunately, it's going to be another document we have to have in writing. But what I'm hoping is we can make it into more of a sort of interesting, engaging process if we can. We end up with a document in writing because we're required to, but hopefully we can, I'd like to think we can take some sort of evidence and examples of things that have happened to the scheme over the period that you're reviewing, things that have gone well, things that haven't maybe gone so well, big projects that have happened, changes to the scheme, people that are involved might have changed, and use all of those things to sort of look at, gather together some evidence and examples that help you with this assessment process. Perhaps look back through all your minutes for that period, give yourself a bit of a refresher of what's happened. And then perhaps you want to get together the people that are going to be responsible for the AURA. That might be all of the trustees, might be a subcommittee perhaps. Have a call and start looking at some of those events that have happened. So, for example, with one of my schemes in December, we had an employer contribution was paid one day late. So obviously not ideal, because then you've effectively breached your schedule of contributions. But there was a process that then followed. So our administration team picked it up because of their cash flow monitoring, raised it with the trustees and the employer straight away. The employer gave us a reason why it happened, and it was simply an administrative problem at their end. And gave some assurances that they'll make some adjustments so that won't be repeated. The trustees went through the process of looking at whether this breach needs to be reported to the regulator. They recorded their decision and made a log of that breach for future reference as well. So actually, I think that kind of thing, even though it's not ideal to have an error happen in the first place, it is really positive that it shows there is a process there, it was followed, and it resolved the matter quickly. So actually, that kind of thing, I think, is really good evidence that in your own risk assessment, you can point to that to show that that process was really successfully working. And on the flip side, perhaps if you've got a missed payment and it doesn't come to light maybe till later on, maybe you're going through an audit of the accounts and that's when it comes to light. Perhaps again, that is reflecting that your monitoring could be a bit stronger, or you've got a weakness in your process somewhere along the line that, you know, could be improved. And again, it's not ideal that that's happening, but if it helps you improve for the future, then that's really positive. So I'm hopeful that we can use that kind of approach to make it interesting, and it kind of brings it to life, having some real life examples rather than just looking at a policy on paper. Like you said, with the cyber incident plan, it's very, you have something down on paper, but in real life, how will it actually work? I think we can hopefully make it a bit more interesting for trustees.
Yeah, I think that's totally right, in that, in a similar way, but probably more so than the gap analysis, that the aura needs to be a sort of an engaging process for the trustees. And being subjective is a little bit foreign. And sometimes, you know, trustees go through an actuarial evaluation. The results are the results. I'm not an actuary, so I can say that. you've got an investment strategy. You've got a way to go. And you decide how to go there, and you get there. The aura is going to be a lot more subjective. This is what we've done. Has it worked? And they have to think about that. And I think it's about those conversations and having those conversations. I mean, it's kind of in one of my clients, you've got a really good, well-engaged trustee board, but one of the trustees was appointed by the employer a long time ago to effectively be an employer representative on the board. But everyone who appointed him has now left the employer, and no one really knows that that's what his role. I mean, he realizes he's the trustee as well as all the other trustees. So he's brought this up and said, well, actually, we need to look at the trustee board, governing body, to use the parlance. Is this still right? And that's, it's kind of bringing that thing into light as well. And one thing we haven't mentioned yet is this risk management function. And I've found that actually with the few schemes that have properly embraced that risk management function, either as a subcommittee or perhaps one trustee leading, that's really helped as well. And I think that will really help the aura process to start with, because it's usually, let's be honest, it's usually the trustees who want to be involved. So you get much more engagement from them in the first place. And then with the secretary's support, that subcommittee can then go back to the full board and hopefully get full engagement from the full board and get them all talking about these things.
Sorry, Chris, can you just expand a bit more? The risk management function, what do you mean? What is that different to the ESOG? Is that different to what trustees
are doing? ESOG should really have a risk management framework, which is all your documents, effectively put it very simply. The risk management function will be that the person or persons responsible for making sure that runs effectively. With most of my schemes, we're going down a sort of subcommittee route. A lot of them already had a governance subcommittee. Mm-hmm. So use that governance subcommittee. And what they will do is they'll review all the new documents, they'll review all the old documents, and they'll put proposals forward to the full board. And it actually says in the code, no policy should take effect until the full board has approved them, which is quite a good steer. We don't want subcommittees going off and doing everything on their own. But as long as you have proper terms of reference in place, that's starting to work quite well, I think, and starting to get things done a bit more efficiently.
Mm. I just wanted to ask one other question on the general code, sort of the level of proportionality. You know, there isn't a massive in there for smaller schemes, but is there enough, you know, could there be more, you know, ways of just making sure that, because the way you guys are talking, you know, there's a lot of value in here. Like Catherine, you're talking through the aura process, which could be a really valuable sort of review and narrative in a sort of more engaging way. We've also had through risk register reviews. They aren't the most engaging meetings in the world when you go through every line of the risk register. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, but the aura is kind of a more of a, let's look at the highlights of the year or the narrative of the year, things that happened, things that didn't, all that kind of stuff, which might be quite an engaging and fruitful discussion. But you want to make sure that the trustees are getting some value for doing this. And is there enough in the code to sort of bridge that gap between proportionality, but then actually bringing some value to the board and the way they work and the way they operate and run the scheme?
I think it's difficult to put that into a code of practice.
Mm.
Because I think you will, I mean, going back to the trends and the common approaches, in all honesty, whilst more and more schemes are engaging with this, it is the well-run, better-run schemes that engaged first and I've done the most on it.
Mm.
And it'll the small, not necessarily the small schemes, that's wrong, the perhaps less well-run schemes that are lagging behind. And I think that will always be the case, whatever is in a code of practice, however much of a steer the regulator gives. I think there will always be schemes that think, well, we're not going to do anything, we don't have to submit anything, therefore it's only a problem if we get caught. And that attitude is out there, much as we try to talk people out of it. So I'm not sure, I'm happy for Catherine to disagree, but I'm not sure what more you could put in the code. You can't really give a steer on proportionality, I don't think.
Mm.
No, all I'd say is I really welcome the fact that there is repetition through the whole code about proportionality, scheme size, complexity, nature, where you are in the life cycle of the scheme. I think that's just sensible that you can take all those things into account, and that's the best way forward, I think, rather than requiring everyone to do everything when it just doesn't really bring any benefit. So I think the way that they've done it is the right way to do it, I think.
I agree.
Gives that
I do agree completely. The problem is a lot of schemes that are going for buy-in or are already in buy-in, they still need to do a lot of this governance, but they've swept it under the carpet because they think we're at buy-in now. We're going to be buy-out in a year, 2 years. This doesn't apply to us. So it's had the reverse effect as well, I think. Rather than proportionality, some trustee boards have seen zero, which I don't think is right either.
No, the buy-in phase is quite interesting. When you actually start thinking about it, you realise it's actually more complex because you're introducing a whole new third party.
Yeah.
So we're, you know, say we're the third party administrator. We're still here. So hello, yes, we still engage with your members. We're still appointed by you. You've just outsourced this element of it to an insurer. So you now need to start kicking their tires and asking them questions and getting their assurance. It's a whole other level. It actually makes it more complex rather than easier in some ways. I don't know if you've got either of you've got experience of doing that and having to have that discussion and probably a surprising discussion.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I mean, I'm going back to a point you made. A couple of minutes ago, I actually was involved in quite an engaging risk register workshop.
I don't believe you.
where we focused on buy-in risks, and then then subsequently the risks of moving from buy-in to buy-out. And fortunately, the trustees were really engaged in that, and it did show there's a hell of a lot more governance left in a scheme once you've bought in. Very little of it, and I've been talking to the guys in our smart team as well who do the insurance broking, very little governance drops away on buy-in.
Given we're all advocates of trustee secretaries and scheme secretaries, because we're all one, I'm one. Chris, I'm just going to get you just to try to sort of sum up maybe some of the myths around what secretaries are and what they actually do and what they can bring to the table and what they can do to help trustees manage their schemes.
Yeah. I think there's an unfortunate and wrong stigma to the word secretary, particularly in this case. You're seen as when someone says trustee secretary, you're seen as a minute taker. Perhaps you arrange a meeting pack, perhaps you arrange an agenda, but not much more. But there is so much more to the role these days. And I think, you know, I wouldn't go as far as to say you could be called governance managers, but it's going in that direction. And I think that the key to it is, being a scheme secretary, whether you're working for a firm that's providing all services to a scheme or you're one of a number of advisors, one of your main jobs is to bring everyone together. Even if there's a professional trustee involved, you're still bringing everyone together. They're relying on you to a certain extent to do that. And on top of that, there's a sort of project management aspect to it all as well. So almost a day-to-day project management as much as a management of ongoing projects. There's always a risk, I think, of micromanaging. It's a balance. You know, you can be on the backs of advisors all the time, which isn't right, and you can give them too much slack, which probably isn't right either. So I think the good secretaries out there, they will have that balance. They'll keep things on track, and they'll do that by managing people and managing expectations as much as possible. And I think more and more, it's more a consultant than a secretary. More and more scheme secretaries are expected to be consultants rather than a traditional secretary. The traditional secretarial part of it is secondary, I would say, mostly these days. Catherine, I don't know what your experience is.
I definitely agree with that. The classic part of the role, I think, is obviously very important. You need to make sure the meetings are run very efficiently. You want very comprehensive, clear minutes. And I think that in itself is quite a skill. But as you said, it's the day-to-day management, the day-to-day dealing with all these different queries that come your way from all different directions, knowing what needs to be raised up to the trustee level and knowing what things you can sort out without involving them. And that, I think, helps the trustees to just focus on those really important decisions they've got to make, strategic decisions, without having to run, deal with the running every day of the scheme. Because let's be honest, a lot of trustees have got other day jobs. This is something they're trying to find time in their day to be a trustee as well, trying to find time to do training. And actually, they just haven't got time to do all of this. So I think the trustee role, the trustee secretary role, is really important from that point of view. And you know, we are losing a lot of lay trustees, member nominated trustees. We can't get people engaged in it, and we can't. It's a big role. It's an awful lot of burden on their shoulders. So if we can come in and take some of that away, I think that's helpful as well.
Yeah, I think trustees are certainly in the cases I've seen are starting to realise that the secretary is another advisor. That is what they are. They're not just there taking minutes. But that's to touch on the point you made, Catherine. That's not to do down the skills, the traditional secretarial skills. I mean, we all love getting sort of good reports in our minutes. I think one of my best was a masterful avoidance of the split infinitive, which I'm that's going to be on my headstone, I think. So yeah, those skills have to be there. They still have to be there, but is much more to it, much more not more but more and more interesting aspects of it as well.
I agree completely. I mean, I think it's interesting is the role has developed in the years I've been doing it. You know, you can get, if you get a really good relationship with your chair, you can be that right hand. You know, you're sat there, you know, for a few of my boards I've done sort of a chair's friendly agenda, you know, so they're clear before what we're discussing under each item, what the decision, you know, just to guide them through. They know, but sometimes, you know, like you're saying, Catherine, they've got a lot on their plate sometimes, especially if they're lay trustees. You know, they're dealing with other with day jobs and whatever, and sometimes they do need that person. But like, I don't know, like a clerk of the court or something. You know, there's lots of other kind of roles. You're sort of there. You know, you've got someone making decisions. Yeah, you know, we're not making decisions. We're not decision makers in the room, and that, you know, that's that rests with them. But giving them everything they need, all the information they need to be able to make their decisions, execute the deed and the rules and everything properly. As I get quite often get called on to say, you know, I'll be Cora, you know, how do you make this decision? You know, is this deed signed properly? You know, the lawyers will be there in the background as well, but sometimes lawyers are less likely to be in the room these days over recent years. And so you do need somewhere in the room to say, this process is being followed appropriately. This decision is being made properly. And because nobody wants to have to go back and realize you did it wrong or have to do it again. And then it comes through to the minutes and the recording, and your fantastic minutes, Chris, are legendary, obviously. mine are legendarily short, which I don't know if that's good or bad, but you know, there you go. Just keep it brief. But yeah, but
I was going to say, I think it's being in the room that's I love that the best part of my job is being in the room, but it's between meetings as well. You know, when you've got a chair who either will pick up the phone to you or you can pick up the phone to them in between meetings, because they know that you're going to get things done. And that's a sign of success, I think, as well. And sort of watch a lot of American dramas. In some ways, I see myself as a bit of a chief of staff role. You know, you're kind of coordinating everything. Making sure things run properly. Yeah, as Catherine, you said it, taking the burden off trustees. That's the point of it. Trustees have got enough to think about. If we can make their jobs even a little bit easier, then great.
Okay, I think we'll leave it there, guys. Time has caught up with us. So thank you, Chris. Thank you, Catherine, for your thoughts on all things trustee secretarial. So much more we didn't talk about, so we'll do another one of these later on in the year. Perhaps an update on the Aura process from you, Catherine, as well. Okay, so thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of the broadcast.